what we're seeing over the last year, 18 months, is a much growing, greater appetite from investors and enterprise to take positions in health tech innovation. And so 2017 broke all records and far exceeded what 2016 achieved, and placing Asia really at the moment number two in the world in relation to total venture funding deployed in health tech.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. My guest this episode, and you've just heard his voice, is Julian de Salaberry, founder and CEO of Galen Growth Asia. He's a self-described healthcare change catalyst, which is to say that he and his partners at Galen Growth invest in and catalyze connections between healthcare and technology. Julian started off in big pharma and was in the midst of overseeing a major global merger when he had an epiphany. I asked him to start there.
As I started looking at the, I guess, the broader market outside the four walls of my organization, I started identifying pockets of innovation that were driven by pieces of technology such as, say, the iPhone or the Samsung smartphone. That particular solution, when equipped with the right business model, could start making a difference at a community level, for example, or at a physician level, depending on what pain point you're trying to solve here. But what I did discover as well was that the organization I worked for had a strategy that didn't necessarily allow for greater dialogue with those type of pockets of innovation. And so that was my trigger to step out of a large organization and establish my own venture, really, very focused on early stage investment, so that I could start enabling some of these technologies to move forward.
And then how do you work that? Are you working in partnership with consulting firms, pharmaceuticals, healthcare ministries around the region? How do you now build that ecosystem?
So that is the purpose of Galen Growth Asia. My journey with this venture that I set up called the Propel Group was very much around identifying worthy technology or solutions that would have a positive impact on healthcare in the region and put in the right amount of investment behind it to actually enable it to scale up to the next level. Now, we started out looking at Asia innovation for Asia healthcare. But when we set out, this is back in 2012, and I say we because I'm not the only investor in this particular venture, we recognized the fact that the maturity of that innovation in Asia wasn't quite what it needed to be. And therefore, we started looking in the US and Europe and made a number of investments in the US. But more recently, I guess, we've looked at innovation in this region and been investing in this region. But to your point, we also recognized that, a bit like Silicon Valley, really, the reason an environment, an ecosystem really starts enabling the innovation to scale, to start bringing value to society, is because of the various moving parts of that ecosystem. And so Asia, for all of those who are familiar with it, is a very fragmented environment. Every country is very different. The regulations are different. Its languages are different, etc. And therefore, we needed to start bringing these pieces together. Now, Singapore has always positioned itself as being the innovation hub for Southeast Asia, at least, and therefore is the right platform, the right center of gravity for this, but you still need that catalyst to bring together these various stakeholder groups. And by stakeholder groups, I'm talking about entrepreneurs who are bringing the ideas to the table, investors that are bringing in important money fuel, I guess, to scale up, clinicians, who are obviously very important in any, certainly medical validation of a particular solution, corporates, because they're looking for solutions, but also they have the reach you were talking about earlier on. And of course, you add to that government that play a very major role, government agencies, not just necessarily the core of government. And the last one that I do not forget, of course, is media. You've got to spread that word. You've got to try and create that contagion, really, around the fact that this is something here.
And what's the appetite for health tech or these types of technologies that enable healthcare or extend the reach of healthcare? You mentioned how fragmented it is in Asia. Yep. One of the arguments right now is building beyond the hospital, creating monitoring or devices where you can reach and extend to people who are in more rural areas, less reachable areas. Sure. There are doctor crunches and therefore shortage of doctors, sure, which are going to pose issues. And of course, everyone's concerned as they look to the U.S. on the escalating cost of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And lots of governments are saying, where it is largely public sector in Asia, lots of governments are saying, we simply can't afford that. Technology might be able to help.
Absolutely. All those are very valid. So to bring these people together, to bring the value of that technology, and we'll look at how that addresses different markets in a couple of seconds. And I say we in this context in terms of a number of founders, entrepreneurs of health tech, Ventures and myself, a small number, got together and established Galen Growth Asia. And we took that venture to industry and said to industry, listen, we believe that we need to act as that catalyst. What do you think? And industry backed us to actually establish Galen Growth Asia. So we're about 2 years old, and our purpose is really around working with all these moving parts to enable innovation to come to fruition. And innovation in this context can be genomics, it can be telehealth, it can be remote health, it can be literally just wellness, fitness type applications. And we'll come back to that in a minute. Your point's correct. Asia-Pac has different levels of maturity. We describe them in three different buckets. You have the mature economies, so the Singapore, the Hong Kongs, the Australias, the Japan, and we'll come back to that. What I call the developing economies, so the China, the India, the Indonesia of this world, and of course the new frontier markets, very much the Laos, Cambodia, Myanmar, and we'll come back to that as well. Each of them have very different pain points, or certainly accentuation of pain points versus each other. So Singapore's issues when it comes to healthcare are very different than Myanmar's. And I guess anyone who knows most markets will know that just visibly it looks different.
Yeah. Could you characterize that? Like what would be some of the requirements in Singapore versus in Myanmar?
So Singapore has a very well-established, mature health system. And like most mature markets, it's facing challenges of growing chronic disease, an aging population. And all of that means that you need to work out how to continue delivering the high standard of healthcare, but at a price point you can afford, because your aging population means your workforce is reducing, which means your tax receipts are reducing. But your costs of providing elderly care, but also managing chronic care, such as diabetes, are only going up. Therefore, you've got to get that balance right. Myanmar's contrast.
Well, let me ask you, so what's a good example of a health tech solution for the Singapore market, given those set of circumstances?
So one of the two of the more recent and one of our neighbors is actually addressing this particular issue, which is how do you enable better distribution allocation of elderly care rather than going through necessarily the government institutions? How do you provide that on a more private manner and get access to it via, let's say, a mobile application in terms of, and it could be nursing, but also could be just, removing the loneliness barrage that an elderly person has, because they live by themselves.
So remote management of elderly care. So people living in their flats and not needing or being able to get out, but needing and being able to then check on them using applications or technologies.
So the theory, and it's one that I think we all probably espouse, which is you would rather somebody continue living in their own home than actually gets moved into an old people home or a clinic. They're quality of life is better, the longevity of their life will be greater, and the burden on state is, of course, lesser. And therefore, how do you enable that? So remote healthcare is one way of doing it. So, it could be as simple as sensors that say, well, Jimmy used to, make a cup of tea at 11 a.m. every morning without fail, but the last 2 days he hasn't. Mm. How do we take action to actually, inquire as to why that is?
We hope Jimmy's okay.
Well, it could be that Jimmy's got a cold, but it actually could be that Jimmy's had a fall.
Right.
But no one's going to have a look.
And the Singapore government has been very explicit about this. They have stayed away from the idea of retirement homes or nursing homes. In fact, they've created tax incentives for families to be near to their elderly parents or grandparents and encouraging this idea of care. Technology, again, is just a way of extending and reassuring that there's coverage even when, a son or a daughter or a grandchild isn't around.
Yeah, mature markets, China is kind of similar, but mature markets generally have seen a centralization of the provision of healthcare. And therefore, the burden has gradually moved on to the state infrastructure. It's no different in the UK. The US is slightly different, of course, because it's a highly privatized model. But still, the hospital tends to take the burden. And what governments are trying to do in a more generalized way is move people out of it so that the individual in the hospital is actually there because they need to be there. And the needs of those who are not necessarily needing hospital actually being addressed somewhere else. But China is an interesting demonstration of that as well, where most of the healthcare in China is provided by hospitals. But the Chinese government has recognized the fact that to actually alleviate the burden, I don't know if you've ever been to a Chinese hospital, but the queue is massive and you can spend hours just to see a doctor just for a few minutes.
Right.
You may just be there because you've just got a sore ankle or you've got a cold. You shouldn't be in the hospital. And if the Singapore government's trying to find ways of leveraging technology, for example, to move people out of the hospital. So that phenomenon is something that's occurring in most mature markets. How do you leverage technology to provide the care that's required in a more localized basis. So rather than moving the patient to a place of care, how do you move the care to that patient?
Yeah, and I guess they're doing it in the two-pronged way in China, aren't they? One is those who can afford it, they're pushing them into private healthcare, mm-hmm. where you don't have the long lines, you have high-quality care, you know, modern technology and modern facilities. That's one way. But the other way, as you say, is kind of maybe creating a network of clinics or outsource centers or monitoring labs and remote so that you can actually, people can stay at home and they can dial in there or whatever, just to make their data available on a rolling basis to make sure that everyone's healthy and happy. And this is the one thing that China keeps talking about, right? They know that as a public healthcare system, they cannot afford to continue to provide these high-end services, particularly when you're getting to MRIs and cancer treatments, which are wildly expensive.
Correct. I mean, and you look at the price of the new oncology drugs coming out. You know, there's a great deal of screaming out there as to the price per patient.
Yeah, $1 million, right?
Well, in the worst possible case, yes. But generally, you're sitting at the more $300,000, $400,000 for the latest treatments. Right. But, you know, how long can governments or even insurance companies continue to reimburse or cover the cost of these? Right. So there's a need to start looking at ways of being more efficient elsewhere in the system. But remember, when you look at the cost of healthcare in a mature market, it's pretty much the same rule all over. That 10% is drug related, as in the product related. The rest is about health services, the provision of healthcare. So that's why a need to be more efficient is required, and technology will help. But technology also help, you know, reduce errors, will help accelerate certain diagnosis or certainly a diagnosis. So it's not necessarily about just literally stripping costs out. It's also about being more effective, let's say, in a way in which healthcare is provided. But that's the luxury of a mature market.
Right.
If you jump the other end of the spectrum and start looking at Myanmar, I mean, for those people who have visited Myanmar or Burma, as it's called in certain countries, it's a beautiful country. It's one that I love visiting from a sheer photography perspective because it's of its naturalness, its rawness, its unspoiltness, let's say. But as a result of what? A result of 50 years of being closed down and underinvested. And you can see that in the health system. You know, the lack of investment means that there is insufficient numbers of healthcare professionals, insufficient hospitals, and some very rudimentary primary care, let alone specialist care, being provided in that country.
I'm Steve Stein, and my guest is healthcare change catalyst Julian de Salisbury, founder and CEO of Galen Growth. More in a moment. This is Inside Asia, and you've been listening to my conversation with healthcare industry investor Julian de Salisbury, founder and CEO of Galen Growth. We've been talking about the ways in which he and his partners surface healthcare solutions and then connect those solutions with targeted investments, putting capital and innovators to work. Different economies have different challenges, and I asked Julian what a health tech solution in a developing market like Myanmar looks like.
Well, this is where you get into a very interesting conversation because you could say to yourself, listen, Myanmar has a lot of investment to do in order to catch up an average OECD country in terms of standard of care. But you then have to get into the conversation of how long does it take to achieve this? I mean, take India as an example, just a pure relative here. Latest stats I saw about India would describe that for India to reach a physician density that is commensurate with an OECD country, it'd probably take 85 years to build, purely in sheer time of training people, et cetera.
And assuming that's a benchmark, a ratio between doctor, patient of a certain level. But that's an assumption that we're, right? Or is that?
You take the actual number sitting in India and you take the average of an OECD country and then you look at that delta and okay, so how long would it take to breach? That gap. Yeah. Now, India could take 85 years.
Or they could do what?
Or they start looking at reaching resources elsewhere in order to provide that provision of healthcare. So, you know, telehealth being a particular type of solution. But of course, how do you also equip the patient to be able to take greater ownership? Or how do you equip a healthcare professional of a lower, let's say, skill set to actually be able to upscale through technology? So don't necessarily place the burden always on the physician, for example. But you can imagine, if you wait 85 years, just imagine the compounding of chronic care disease. Diabetes has been a huge issue in that country. Therefore, the impact on workforce productivity and therefore the impact on GDP of that country. It's the same argument that sits with Myanmar. And therefore, the argument really at Myanmar level is, do you allow the country to try and build the infrastructure that, say, a UK or an Australia has? Or do you look at solutions that will enable it literally to leapfrog some of these issues. And so you start looking at a provision of primary healthcare through technology rather than necessarily trying to emulate what an Australia or UK has built over decades, if not centuries.
Julian, you know, you hear we've been through these waves of technology, technological change, and we're in the latest wave of AI, you know, these ideas of IoT, Internet of Things, the idea that the remote monitoring devices and whatnot. How much, in your opinion, is hype and how much is real? Are these applications just on, you know, on the cusp, or are we looking at another 5, 10, 15 years before they really come to fruition?
It's an interesting point you make, simply because we at Galen Growth Asia certainly try and spend a little time talking about specific technologies. You and I could debate until we're blue in the face the merits of blockchain or AI in healthcare, but without really starting to look at a particular pain point in the health system you're trying to solve, it almost is meaningless or valueless. But to come back to your question, there's a great deal of research ongoing. By research, I mean R&D going on and development of the application of AI in healthcare or blockchain, etc. Some of it is hype in terms of the actual effective change it's creating in healthcare. We're still a way away from there. Whether it's 15 years, whether it's 10 years, I don't know. We seem to be in an environment where we're seeing the reverse of Moore's law, really, in terms of the effectiveness of those solutions exponentially growing year on year. And therefore, you know, who knows? You know, IBM is claiming that it's made substantial steps forward in relation to quantum computing. So if they are proven in what they're claiming, then what do we see that translate in terms of the power of AI, et cetera? But the application of those technologies is certainly very valuable. In AI, I've certainly seen far more concrete application and solutions coming through. If you go to the US primarily, of course, you'll see some of the more advanced applications of AI. In the field of radiology, for example, we're starting to see some very interesting radiology support or aid in terms of being able to identify potential health issues, but as a support to the healthcare professional. In blockchain, it's still early days in terms of how that will actually transform healthcare. It has huge merit, but I've not actually seen anything yet that I would describe as usable.
In the world of healthcare, technology is a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
So in many ways, you know, you have this rollout of MRIs or advanced diagnostic equipment, and the costs associated with actually using those products are then growing the costs of healthcare and raising expectations and demand from your population. And in some ways, you're sending it into a bit of a upward spiraling maelstrom. How do you manage the application of technology while maintaining and managing down the costs of care?
Well, large pieces of equipment like MRI machines you refer to will always be an expensive CapEx investment for hospitals. And so there, the hospital is desperately trying to find ways of getting a greater throughput. In other words, my cost per patient is going down. And so the intention there is to enable hospitals to achieve that. Now, if you look at other types of technology in the system, you hope that the access, the volume access to those particular solutions will drive a price when it's lower. The overall context, I think we should bear in mind when we look at health tech, and that's that conversion of tech and health improving patient outcome, is that we're seeing really two major phenomena, really, that the barrier to entry in terms of innovation is dropping fast. You know, we're no longer necessarily looking at a molecule type research to be able to try and solve a problem. We're looking at other types of technologies to get there. I guess the cost of commercially and clinically validating that technology is dropping fast as well. To try and address your point, what we're going to see is new solutions coming through from health tech being priced, logically being priced at a much lower price point than, say, some of the the other technologies you were referring to earlier on.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, it's really when you look at some of the investments going on in the region. I think in your latest report, you talked about $2.6 billion in investments, something like 240 deals in 2017, which exceeded those in 2016. But the relative size of those deals were quite small, which would suggest that people are coming in at more of the A, B, or the seed round, and maybe some of the bigger deals are less interesting or less available to people. But they are. It does look like there's a democratization of investment around health tech in a way. Which, you know, 3, 5, 6 years from now could create quite a few interesting applications.
So you were very encouraged by what we're seeing in that analysis. So we're very unique in our ability at Gale & Growth Asia to be able to generate that insight in terms of the investment landscape. So in the US, there are a number of reports that address that. In Asia Pacific, this is the first time that any organization will be able to do it. Your point is quite interesting because, in fact, what we're seeing over the last year, 18 months, is a much greater appetite from investors and enterprise to take positions in health tech innovation. And so 2017 broke all records and far exceeded what 2016 achieved. And placing Asia really at the moment number 2 in the world in relation to total venture funding being deployed in health tech.
Ahead of Europe.
Ahead of Europe, absolutely. And only about 50% of the way behind the US, which is roughly speaking five and a bit billion. So it gives you a flavor. Now, China is taking the lion's share of that deal value in terms of total dollar deployed. In total volume of deals, we're seeing India exceed China. But to answer your point in relation to deal pattern, what we've noticed in the last 12 months is a growing volume of the pre-A, series A type deals. So that sort of real inflection point in a venture's life cycle where they start picking up their first big chunk of cash to try and grow the business. And so we've seen a growing volume of those deals, but a lowering in terms of total dollar deployed. So you can infer from that, therefore, that the ticket size, as it's generally referred to, has reduced in terms of the Series A size. So more deals, but less money per deal being deployed. We're actually seeing the reverse going on in Series B and Series C. So there we've seen the dollar's value growing. Mm. And so what we're seeing is that a greater number of Series B, Series C, so the growth stage of funding, in terms of number of players, in terms of dollars being deployed, which is very heartening because it's really describing a great appetite of investors, those focused on growth stage. And therefore, really, you can infer from that there is a maturing of the health tech ecosystem in Asia Pacific.
And there's also, I think, the majority, the lion's share of investment or deals are occurring in India and China. I think combined, they represented something like 65-70% of the whole, which makes sense because not only are those large markets with extremely complex healthcare challenges, but it's also vibrant in terms of investment environments, entrepreneurs, and government support and for these types of ventures.
Yeah, I mean, so China is driving two of that 2.6 billion. Mm-hmm. That makes sense in terms of the sort of size of enterprise investing. You know, a lot of Tencent, Alibaba money is being directed towards healthcare, for example. The government is much more directive in terms of its use of technology or the use of technology in terms of improving healthcare. So we're seeing certainly the right drivers in China to enable that to happen. Deal size is generally much bigger in China anyway, but to your point, it's interesting in relation to India. India, we're seeing a growing in volume, not necessarily seeing a growth or the same sort of scale in terms of total value or dollar value per deal in India yet. I mean, India is growing and maturing, I guess, slightly later than China is. So it's natural to see what we're seeing going on in India. And so over time, we should start seeing India playing a greater role or featuring more prominently here in terms of health tech venture funding and health tech innovation. So much so that we at Gale & Growth Asia will start looking at India much more, with much greater focus, and pretty much akin to how we've been looking at China in the last year in terms of what deals, what type of deals are going on, and what type of technology has been invested in. Okay. But we shouldn't ignore some of the other economies that are going on. Indonesia is growing very fast in terms of deal volume in the past 12 months. And it's somewhat in contrast to some of the things you were saying a little bit earlier on. You know, when you look at Japan, it's much quieter. But I think some of that, and this is a hypothesis more than anything we've specifically validated, but I think some of that is where does the pain point lie? Mm-hmm. Whereas China, India, and Indonesia, the pain point's much more at a patient level. Japan is much more like the UK or the US, where the pain point is much more at a payor or government level, and therefore the incentive by of a patient or an individual to take ownership of their healthcare is less so.
Julian, masterful job in giving us a look at the Asia-Pacific healthcare landscape. We wish you great luck and thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to share this, to infuse the excitement in health tech with the audience.
Thank you. I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. You've been listening to my conversation with Asia healthcare sector champion and early stage investor, Julian DeSalaberry, founder and CEO of Galen Growth. At the end of each podcast, I like to leave my listeners with a last thought, a kind of Asia Insider Minute in which I try to make sense of what we've just heard. Let me start off with the observation that Healthcare Change Catalyst was not a job title brought to my attention by my high school guidance counselor. It was a simpler world in a lot of ways. You got sick, you went to the doctor, he listened to your heart and checked your pulse, mumbled a few words to the nurse, scribbled on a piece of paper, and sent you home to eat chicken soup and sleep it off. That, in the day, was healthcare, or at least my neophyte notion of it. In middle school, I read a lot of science fiction and had a particular weakness for Isaac Asimov. The Foundation trilogy and I, Robot were among my favorites. I must confess that at no point during my occasional visits to the doctor's office as a young man did I envisage healthcare being anything more than a doctor in a lab coat with an air of wisdom. It never once occurred to me that Dr. Larson and his band of nurses might one day be replaced by implantable chips, mobile diagnostics, and microscopic bots let loose in your bloodstream. Healthcare is deliciously complex, which is why investors the world over are salivating over ways to both simplify the process of insuring, managing, and monitoring patients, while at the same time applying shockingly sophisticated new devices and medications to preserve and enhance human life. As Julian DeSalaberry and his partners at Galen Growth are showing us, these are different times. There's huge investment in R&D ranging from robotic surgery to genome decoding to AI-enabled predictive health screening, so much so that it feels like we're living in a world where the inverse of Moore's law is the rule. Processing power is improving exponentially, and healthcare solutions are top beneficiaries. As in the case in other sectors, technology for technology's sake tend to run amok, and what we end up with, at least in the initial years, is some very fancy, sexy stuff that's either entirely unscalable or unaffordable. In Asia, and particularly among the less developed markets, health tech solutions will need to remain far more focused on the practical versus the dramatic. It's all well and good for the wealthy to grow replacement organs in a petri dish in order to live to 150 years and beyond. But what about the tens of millions of poor and underserved people who still can't afford to see a doctor, let alone insure themselves against the costs of unexpected illness? Is there a healthcare solution for them? Governments across the region are asking for, and investors are looking for, health tech solutions designed to drive down the cost of healthcare. Do this, and the payoff is huge. Change is on the horizon no matter what healthcare market you inhabit. Note that the barriers to entry, whether they have to do with clinics or computers or governments, are coming down. With the right incentives, focus, and tech applications, the democratization of healthcare is within our grasp. Rest assured, doctors aren't going away anytime too soon, but tech might just translate into far fewer trips to the doctor's office. Our new healthcare overlords, or those doctors of the future, may come in the form of Fitbit bracelets and implantable devices that feed our healthcare vitals to a central database 24/7. First sign of illness and a quick release of microscopic bots into the bloodstream should sort you out. Asimov, eat your heart out. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia. Thanks for listening.